When the recording is done, Mark, we can make that available online, can't we?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Does that work for you?
Yeah, that would be great.
Give you the record, give you the link.
Yeah, it's better than me recording it on my phone, which is what I normally do.
Well, this just will record the video system internally.
So. Oh, perfect. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I would record on your phone for a backup in case something
goes crazy.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah. But it's actually pretty reliable.
Yeah.
I'm not certain how many people are going to be participating here.
Okay, so I just emailed Steve. I guess that's Steve's voice that I hear.
Yeah, that's Steve, me. Yeah. That's Steve.
I just emailed you my consent form.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, here, let me.
I read it carefully. I marked up any objections and comments, and no, I didn't. I didn't even read
Excellent.
It.
Excellent. Perfect.
There's mine.
Yeah, it's curious how...
We're human subjects?
Yeah, whenever you kind of tell the IRB what you're doing, you suddenly have a lot of paperwork to fill out. You wonder how many people do this stuff and then don't tell anyone they're doing it.
Yeah.
The mat should be here too, but for a few minutes early.
I didn't know they had a video system in A110, Mark.
Yeah.
You just have to have it set up in advance, or...
I've seen you on this TV, though, before.
I guess that's true, yeah.
Right. But I guess we all look the same, no matter, you know, kind of...
Yeah, no matter what room you're in.
Then it sounded like, what was it, from Florida State.
Volker.
Yeah.
I had somebody from MIT and somebody from Northwestern, and I don't know, and somebody from Indiana. I don't know if any of them will connect.
Yeah.
This is Justin from MIT. I'm on ESPN.
Hi, Justin. Oh, okay. I just don't see you. Now there's Florida State.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi, Volker.
Hi, Curtis.
Oh, so don't quite see you yet, but...
1 second. All right, here we go.
There we go. So I put together a rough agenda here. Kind of go through. So when we were, I guess when we were getting ready for this, we should do some introductions after I sort of said a few things. When we were getting ready for our software review last fall, one of the things that was part of the whole thing was the data management plans that the experiments have, and the lab had come up with a plan that basically was a. As far as I can tell, it was a list of services they would provide for data management and then some expectations on the part of the experiments on what they would need to do. And Graham put together a draft of something that was probably appropriate for Hall D. And the various people I'd run into here at CMU, I knew that the library here was interested in, or they'd even been charged with taking or managing these data management plans at the university. And I thought it would be interesting to get somebody from outside of our particle physics area in to come look at this and see if they could give us some advice. And so that's where this meeting came from. So I can introduce, this is Steve here, if you can wave, Steve. And Matt, you can't quite see him there. He's right there, from the university libraries here. And I guess I can sort of, Volker Cordae, the upper screen there, Sean Dobbs at Northwestern, wave. Justin Stevens from MIT, we can't see. And then I'm trying to see who's at JLab.
David Lawrence and Graham Hayes. And okay. I'm Mark Ito.
So, Graham, you can wave your hand, Graham, was the one who had put together the original plan for the hall. And in talking with all these people, I mean, I think it was felt that these were just sort of frameworks that would get us through these things, but a more sophisticated plan would ultimately be developed by the experiments. And that's what we're looking at here. And sort of you have, in the library, you have some sort of interview process that you'd like to try to carry out today that sort of brings you up to speed and sees where things sit. Do you want to say something?
Yeah. So part of what we're doing in the library right now is interviewing a lot of faculty around CMU, and this is a process that happens at a lot of universities who are launching data management services programs. So the interview gives us sort of a sense for the breadth of data problems at the university, essentially. But it also gives us some depth on an individual project, which helps us then turn around and create a data management plan that is fairly helpful, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that we're also hoping to do is to identify, and we have contacted these folks already, identify the data services librarians that are at these other institutions to bring them up to speed to what's going on and make sure that we're sort of meeting all the local institutional data management needs that may pop up. So there are a handful of other data services librarians who are going to be, you know, taking a look and making sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed and whatnot. So and hopefully that will help.
Is this your, in terms of what you've done and breadth of things, is this probably the most unusual one so far? Have you done stranger ones or...?
They're all strange. This is certainly the most multi-institutional one, and from the perspective of kind of coming up with a unique situation, there are a lot of people interested to see what we create for sort of a multi-institutional plan. So there's a fair bit of interest.
Okay.
So
the hope is that what we come up with is not just some piece of paper, but something that will actually benefit all of us at our institutions. And I mean, basically, we'll be in at some level, we might be in the lead on a lot of these things by getting going on this with a project like this. I suspect it'll be useful for the lab to see what we come up with as well, because it may help you in directing other experiments as well. So.
Yeah, you mentioned just before that Graham had put together a plan for...
I think he sent that to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah.
So that's the lab plan.
Okay.
And then there is the... He had a data management plan, which is this page and a half. And it was just... I think it was just... These were very similar for all the halls, weren't they, Graham?
Right. Basically, what happened was that a few years ago, I was approached by a researcher at another institute who was putting in an NSF grant application, and I wrote a data management plan for him. And then last year, the IT division, anticipating that the DOE might require these for grant applications, they wrote a lab-wide plan, and then I was tasked by Rolf, the division head, to take that plan and write a similar document for each one of the four halls. So I wrote a draft of it, and then it was pushed around the four halls, and they looked at it and tailored it to their needs. So basically what you've got there is my, you know, whole D guess updated by Mark and David and some other people here.
Yeah.
Great.
And that was, you know, from the lab's perspective as the outside users with requirements at our own universities, it wasn't, you know, there very likely would be a plan that the collaboration endorses as well that could be in parallel to that. So it may also, they probably ultimately be merged into a single plan, but that's kind of what we're coming out here is what's going on there. And I mean, this is sort of all probably new to a lot of us too. What are we, you know, we're really trying to make sure that our data is at some level available to people outside of our collaboration at some point, that it's maintained, it's not lost. But you also don't want to maintain, keeping track of every little thing that you do is also physically impossible and impossible to find things in. So
Right. There's
got to be some middle ground there.
Yeah.
And so Go ahead, Mark.
Well, since Curtis said this is new to a lot of us, it certainly is new to me. It'd be nice to have sort of an overview about what are the kinds of things that the CMU library, you know, is trying to capture, and then we should say something about what it is that we're tasked with here in the lab, and what are we trying to, you know, because I, you know, just to make sure that they won't match exactly. They can't possibly, right?
Right.
Yeah.
No. So yeah, I can start. So you know, this impetus at CMU and at most other institutions that are starting to deal with these issues has come from primarily from NIH and NSF so far, requiring brief data management plans to be attached to grant applications. But there's an expectation that in the next few months or less, we will see 20 other funding agencies offer similar requirements for data management planning to be a component of a grant application and a focus on compliance around data preservation, access, and sharing issues, you know. So so this kind of idea that open scholarship is the wave of the future is sort of where this is coming from. You know, and we acknowledge that there are some fields that are much better at this than others, and the fact that you have, you know, a plan for the lab down there, and you're sort of already thinking about these things is an indication that you're a step further ahead than some other folks that I've spoken with, certainly, that we hear from. So what we're tasked with at the libraries, along with our research office and the central computing office, is to assist researchers with initially the creation of those short data management plans that go along with a grant application, these sort of two-page documents that NSF requires, but ultimately in creating what we're calling a more operational data management plan, you know, two pages for a large research project is not enough to really sufficiently describe data management at all, right? So what we hope to be able to do and what we're, you know, here to do with you guys is to create an operational data management plan that's more meaningful, that gets down into some of the details of the issues of what data is being created, what are the standards for documentation, standards for access and preservation and whatnot. And then in the end, you know, the research office here and at other institutions is interested in making sure that they're complying with the requirements of a grant, say, so that we can continue to get funding rolling through. And so that's, in a sense, the direction everybody's looking at, is that are we complying with the requirements of these mandates? So that's sort of where we are.
That's really similar to us.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
The denominator being the impetus coming from the funding agencies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, Graham, maybe you want to...
No, I mean that's exactly it. We have had for quite a long time a fully reasonable plan about how we were going to manage the data, and the IT division has sort of tried to capture some of that in the two-page summary. So, for example, I don't think since the day the lab started taking data in a real experiment that we've actually thrown away any raw data. We've kept everything from the beginning. So we've got all of that management capability already built in. So what we tried to do was capture that at the lab level, and then recognizing that each one of the four halls was different, capture that at the hall level. And then the idea was that a collaboration such as BlueX would build upon that plan and write something a little bit more extensive, but then the researcher looking for a grant could point at all of these, the three documents, the lab, the hall, and the collaboration, and say, we've got all of our bases covered. So that's basically where we're coming from.
That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, we don't want grant applicants having to, you know, go and write out the whole thing for themselves every single time.
Right.
we want to provide them with a good base.
But this flurry of activity, if I understood from a few months ago, developing the first set of documents, that was DOE...
That was actually an anticipation of DOE. Roy okay. Whitney, the CIO, was at a meeting and discovered that this was coming down the pipe. I don't think it's actually arrived yet. Maybe it did in the last, just before the holidays. But he anticipated the fact that we would need to provide these things and wanted to get them out there before, you know, the first grant applicant needed something. So I think we got ahead of that.
We've had a couple of instances in the experiment where some NSF people have asked for data plans, and I have cobbled things together that was sort of common and sent it to them. But it led me to believe that we were going to need something that the collaboration as a whole endorsed, and that you basically could click on it, and here's the source file in whatever format you need to just plug it into your grant.
Yeah. What we were anticipating was that the researcher would just have a simple document which would say, I'm researching in such and such a field. I am a member of the GLUX collaboration. We take data and manage our data in accordance with the rules, and here's what they are, and point to all the other documents.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we think about sort of an idealized situation for a researcher filing one of these grant applications, this is exactly, I think, what we're thinking of. Mm-hmm. There are kind of preset policies and plans in place so they don't have to rewrite this every time. So.
And I think with the lab historically, every bit of data that was ever collected
from the accelerator has been meticulously maintained. Once you get beyond that, it all bets are off, I would guess.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
We've actually improved it a lot in the last few years. But a lot of the databases now that support the raw data.
Yeah. Right.
They're all centrally managed by the IT division, and so they're backed up, and they've got all the managed policies in there.
But there was never the policy of so there's a tremendous amount of CPU spent taking the data that comes off of an experiment and putting it into a form that's usable for physicists, and maintaining that data is very important. And then that data goes into some other level, and there's various levels that we've got. So that's kind of what's going on here. So it sounds like we're all on the same page on this.
Yeah, which is great.
Okay.
So is the next thing to
interview? So they have an interview that they'll do, and so I was hoping we could just go through that, and we may wind up arguing amongst ourselves.
Good.
But
that happens.
It is. Nah.
And one more thing we should say before we get too much farther in. So we're recording this on ReadyTalk because they need it, and just so you all know, you're all human experimental subjects right now. So you need to if you can send this form back in signed.
That would be great.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah.
And I think you're recording it on your phone, but
I'll start recording in a minute. And it's in the consent form, but we just use the recording to make sure we don't miss anything, so we can actually listen during the discussion rather than writing notes frantically. And the recordings all get destroyed once we've kind of sufficiently written up, you know, what happens today.
I think ours gets archived forever.
Oh. Well, you're all used to this then.
I don't know how many are recorded, but it happens a lot. Okay.
Okay. So I think what we'll do is get into this thing. Let me start my... So the idea here, as we've just mentioned, is to have kind of a free-form discussion around a number of topics related to the GLUX experiment. And we want to just sort of make sure we get a really good sense of what data are produced, how they're produced, what expectations are around data documentation, during the experiment lifespan, but also after it's all over, expectations for data sharing and whatnot. So I'll kind of run us through a bunch of questions, and hopefully we can all just have a discussion about what's going to happen. So if we could start with just sort of an overall, sort of a very broad description of the project, what it's about, what it's meant to capture as far as information, what questions it's trying to answer.
That's probably mine, and correct me if I say something wrong. So this is a nuclear physics experiment, and we're basically studying the interactions of quarks and gluons inside of the nucleus, and a very particular prediction of the theory that describes this is that the gluons that hold the quarks together can be, in some cases, excited and contribute directly to the properties of the matter that you see. And this matter has not really been observed, or there's hints of it, but it's very strong predictions from very solid theories, and that the main goal is to search for this form of matter. Unfortunately, the search is like looking for a needle in a haystack in terms of the data volumes. The ultimate goal is a nuclear physics experiment trying to understand the very strongest forces in nature and the role that basically confines the quarks inside of protons and neutrons. So why can't you pull a quark out? Why is it always stuck there? And can we study things about this force? So,
great.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
That was a good summary.
Good elevator speech.
Good, very good. So the second question, and this is sort of broadly speaking, what data are generated for the project? We're going to get into some detail about specifics of data, but broadly, what kinds of data are we talking about for the project?
Do you want to do that, Mark, or
me? Okay. Well,
yeah.
Well, the fundamental piece of data that everything revolves around are these recordings of the particle collisions. Okay, and we call those events. So you basically take a snapshot of that collision and measure various properties of the particles which are emerging from the collision. Those events are, how big are the events? The events are about 15 kilobytes, and we take them at a rate of roughly 200,000 a second, 200 kilohertz, and for this experiment. So everything sort of centers around that. Then what you do with those, there's a whole lot of stuff that you do with those afterwards, okay? So what you've recorded are sort of the raw pixels, if you will, of a picture of the collision. But of course, you're not really interested in the picture so much as you are interested in the properties of the particles that are produced and their relationship with each other. Okay, so but to get those relationships and to get those properties, that's a higher level analysis. You have to analyze the picture, in other words, and extract, you know, the signal from the noise and see the particles in there and the relevant properties. And that has to do with a lot of computer code in order to do that. And then, so those events are then transformed into sort of summaries which give you, which are in the language that you're interested in, the physical language of momentum and direction and particle type and things like that. Okay, which are not obvious in the original sort of pixelated capture. So you produce those, and then with those, you look for patterns. You look for statistical tendencies in those particles appearing, their properties, and their relationship to each other. And it has to be statistical because it's fundamentally probabilistic. It's quantum mechanics. By finding those relationships, you learn something about the quantum mechanical amplitudes, the quantum mechanics that's governing what happens, what doesn't happen, and when something does happen, how often it happens. And that of course goes directly into the science, okay, the underlying theory of how these particles go together. To first order, then you have what we call the raw data, which is the photograph kind of thing. You have the reconstructed or processed data, which are the same events but rendered in a more physically meaningful language. And then you have data which is produced out of the analysis, so the statistical analysis itself. So the end result, of course, in terms of volume, you're constantly crunching this down as you traverse this scene, and the other fundamental thing is that there's a huge amount of software involved in all of this at each step. And so if you want to preserve the, if you want to be able, one thing you might want to preserve, okay, is the process for going from the picture to the summary. You might want to be able to say, how did we do that? In order to, as part of the, you know, description of those summaries. So in order to do that, you need to be careful about software versions, because those are changing all the time, of course, and you have to keep track of that. So that's one big problem. The other problem is that you have ancillary numbers which you develop off to the side, which serve as input to the reconstruction process, input to the computer programs on how to process the data, which are not in the original pictures, but are parameters or knobs that you set on the reconstruction process. And those are various types. What we call calibration constants is probably the most common one, the most voluminous. And so the way you set the dials on your reconstruction machine matters, and you have to record all of that too, if you want to be able to preserve the process. So there's that, and you know, you may actually want to go all the way down. I mean, we don't do this, but you can imagine going all the way down to writing down which kinds of computer chips you use to do the thing. Although
I think we're probably never going to have to go there. Yeah.
but you get the idea. You want to not only have the data itself, but also preserve the conditions by which you analyze the data.
Right.
And now I'm running out of steam.
No, that's a pretty good description.
Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah.
The parameters that you mentioned, that's the, like, the geometry of the experiment.
Geometry is one of them. You have a detector that maybe a particle drifts through the gas and gets detected. How does the position versus how long it drifted depend on temperature and pressure? What's the temperature and pressure? So you have to interpolate that. The temperature of a detector may change the gain of an amplifier, and so you've got to follow that temperature and change the, you need all these conditions recorded in a big database that vary in time, and that has your software has to know what to grab and tweak them. So
but you're right that geometry is a great example of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because the geometry as the experiment evolves may actually change. You may move pieces of the detector around, or you may pull out certain pieces of the detector and replace it with others which have perhaps a fundamentally different geometry. So that is that's a right down the middle type example of the kinds of parameters that you have to keep track of when you process the data.
Okay. So the next bit of question here is about the methods used to collect the data. So I've seen the machine. A few months ago that I gather is down there now. But a brief description maybe of what that collection process is like.
Oh, that's me.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, I like this one. Okay. Okay, the data from the detector, when you get one of these events occurring inside the detector, it takes the form of usually of analog signals coming out of the detector along wires or along optical fibers. And we have a large amount of electronics, some of which is custom built, which converts all of those signals into digital numbers. And the digital numbers end up in single board computers embedded close to the detector. What we do is we read out those numbers with software, we package them up, and we send them off over to the network where they're collected by other machines which further process and format the data. Because what you have to realize is the detector is a big thing, so all the data is coming from various points spread out over this huge machine, and you've got to get all of the different parts of the event all into one place so that you can record it. So all of that data is transferred over the network, it's analyzed, manipulated by software. In fact, my group of the laboratory writes a large amount of the software that goes into that process. Once the data is collected and packaged as an event, the stream of events is stored onto disk. From the disk, it's then picked up by the IT people transferred to a disk in the computer center from where it's then staged onto tape. So the raw data from the text matrix kind of flow through the actual hall where the detector is, where all the embedded electronics is, onto fibers over here to the computer center, and then onto the tapes. So it's quite an involved process. But we also, you know, we have to take care of when we store the data, again, what were all the electronics modules in all the different crates at the time when the data was taken, which ones were functioning, which ones weren't, which cables were plugged in and which ones weren't, and all that kind of thing. So all of this goes into this database that Mark was talking about as well.
Okay. So that is captured somewhere, and
yes,
there's an expectation that it will all be sort of held. Okay.
There's the main data flow system, but then there's things called slow control systems that monitor all of this information,
mm-hmm.
capture that in parallel, all with timestamps.
Yeah.
There's electronic logbooks, the people that are taking the data have to enter conditions in, and it's all captured electronically and maintained.
Yeah. Now, we've talked a little bit thus far about analysis methods, but I wonder if there's anything that anybody wants to add about what methods are being used for data analysis during this kind of data production, but also maybe on the once you get past data collection, there's this sort of stuff that happens before publication, say. What are those methods look like?
You want to say something, Dave?
Yeah, I guess I can say. So once we've taken this huge volume of data and written it to a tape somewhere, we do have to go through and process all of it. And so we have, we usually send this to a large computer farm that we have here on site, so we don't have to transfer this large volume of data off site to process it. And the farm will run many, many jobs over the many, many files to kind of do a first pass processing and hopefully reduce the footprint of it some to put it into what we, traditionally we've called summary tapes. So we'll maybe write them to a tape, but to us they really just are files that are sitting on a disk somewhere. So they're really some summary files. And then we can go through a second pass where we may refine it more by filtering out events of a certain physics channel that a person is interested in, and writing those out to a file that is even smaller and in a format that they can then begin to do some final stage analysis with. If you were to look at, for a GUEX experiment, all the stages of this, we'll have the first pass processing where we do the reconstruction. We'll have a second pass where we will filter out, we'll do a kinematic fit, I think, in analysis of the or filter out specific channel into individual files, and then we'll have another pass where we will do a partial wave analysis in the end stage, and that is something that we'll probably do on GPU devices. We have software that can run on GPUs for that, and that may be done at the university level since it's now at a manageable level that we can distribute these what we call, well, I think these are probably going to go out in root files. Somebody's going to argue against that. But these the final stage files will be these files in a format that is common to this field, including high energy physics and nuclear physics and such. So these root files will go out. They'll do some partial wave analysis and try to extract the signal out through various analyses at universities and such. But at each stage, we probably are looking to try to reduce down the footprint by, I would say, at least a factor of 10, if possible.
And these files that are going out to universities, these universities are the universities that I'm seeing around
the table here. Some of them here. There's about 30 institutions in this. And
We do put, just to say another couple of words, a lot of our effort up to now has been on this reconstruction software part. That's very CPU intensive, and it requires input from a lot of people. Each of the major detector systems has some significant manpower behind the software that is put together just to analyze the inputs from that, but then you also have to combine from the different detector systems. Usually information is required from two or three detector systems in order to get the properties of the particles that we're really interested in for the final analysis. So we do have software that's built in inside of a framework that is kind of established early on so that people can contribute different modules to it for the different detector systems. The framework will work with, it will run multi-threaded on a many-core machine so that it can try to take full advantage of the CPU capabilities of a modern box. And what else? It has to have facilities for coupling into calibration databases where it can get constants out of those, where it can grab resources like magnetic field maps and material maps that it uses for the tracking during the reconstruction phase. So there are a lot of fingers that reach out from this reconstruction process in order to kind of do this first stage processing.
Great. And I don't know if it's worth mentioning, but there's also, even in the midst of taking the data, there's an ability to make some decisions. And maybe, Justin, do you want to describe briefly what a software trigger does, if you're there? Did you lose him?
Okay. Sorry, I had to find my mute button. Can you hear me okay? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so the software trigger that we're developing is sort of a way to prune the events that are these collisions that are coming in. Not all of those are interesting for the physics that we want to do. And so to save space on disk resources as well as save on CPU time and reconstruction, the goal is to essentially identify the interesting events with an online CPU farm as they're being recorded, and then reject the ones that are uninteresting. So you just kind of drop those on the floor and they don't even make it to the tape for analysis. And so we're working on the ways to do that, but that's the general idea of how we try to pare down the data before we actually get to the analysis stage, once we get to the sort of higher intensity running that comes later in the stage of the experiment.
And that pruning is happening after this first and second pass?
No, it actually
happening
as the data is being taken.
Okay.
It passes through this farm on its way to the tape.
I see. Okay.
And anything that's obviously not useful is discarded.
So this is sort of a first pass that kind of really gets rid of the junk. Okay.
Of course, you have to be very careful there because if you screw up, you lose your data.
Right. Okay.
Now, is that some kind of like a pattern recognition of a, like the theoretical model events? Or
so Justin,
do you want
to describe a few of the things that feed into that?
Sure. So one of the things that's sort of interesting about the experiment is that we have this photon beam coming in that has a different energy range. And so we're interested in a particular energy range for these photons that are coming, the incident beam on our target inside of our detector. And so we want to identify the interesting events are mostly all at the high energy range. And so there are kinematic properties of events which are a signature of having a high energy photon coming from the beam instead of a low energy photon. And so we can use bits and pieces of information from the different detectors to try to make a quick decision as to whether it was consistent with a high energy photon colliding with our target, and if we can identify those quickly, then it is sort of a pattern recognition kind of a thing where you have an idea of what the kinematics of the particles that are produced are should look like based on what the photon, the incoming beam energy was. And so we can sort of tag those higher energy incident beam events by looking at the particles that are produced in a fast analysis before we would do sort of the full event reconstruction later on after it's written to tape and all that.
Great.
And in fact, the experiment was designed that we would have to discard roughly 80% of our data in this level 3 trigger for us to be able to write it to disk. This has been planned early on that we knew most of the data wasn't useful, but but it looks like it's, we'll probably have something in place much earlier than we thought.
Great.
Yeah, it might also be worth mentioning that to understand the response of the detector to some of these various events, we spend a lot of time making simulations of the detector and its response, and so that's also another pretty important part of data that we use.
So do those simulations take advantage of the same sort of calibration databases and all of that, or are they being run with, you know, whole hosts of other data sets and databases?
The idea is to use the same conditions and the same reconstruction code to reconstruct the event. So, I mean, there's an additional package that does the simulation of the physical processes, and it sort of simulates the passage of particles through the detector. So those are additional software packages. But after that, everything is approximately the same as the actual processing of the data.
Okay.
We have to simulate a comparable amount of data to what we collect.
Excellent.
So
so that sort of gets us to a discussion about how much stuff we're talking about. I'll tell you that I just came from a data interview this morning where the PI was talking about kilobytes of data, and I have a feeling we're many orders of magnitude larger than that.
Tens of petabytes.
Yeah. So if we could kind of go through, we kind of have gone through these, like you mentioned, these sort of steps of, you know, you have the data that passes the trigger, and that's kind of the raw data, and then you have these kind of steps where you whittle things down. If we could kind of go through those steps and talk about how much stuff we're talking about. And then I think this is sort of where a discussion about the Jefferson Lab data management plan that that we've seen comes in. You know, that data management plan talks a fair bit about IT infrastructure and storage and whatnot that is available for experiments that are running at the lab. But what I don't have a good sense for is at what point that infrastructure is not available to be used by an experiment, and that data needs to be hosted somewhere else.
So I guess I can just, I'm just going to this document that we wrote for the software review. It has numbers in it. And on page 62, if anybody's got that. But so we had a, I'm trying to remember if this was initial, it doesn't matter. It was 3.2 petabytes per year of raw data.
Okay.
And the reconstructed was about a third of that, and I don't. And then the simulated data was comparable. It was 2.5 petabytes. So we had something like 7.7 petabytes a year going to tape.
Right.
On this here. That data will likely, at least the raw data, will probably never leave the lab unless they truck the tapes off to put them in a vault somewhere.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at the JLab plan, what we actually do is we take the raw data, and then we make a duplicate copy of the raw data, and then the duplicate tape is taken out of the tape robot and is stored in a fireproof tape vault. So we've actually got two copies of the raw data.
Okay.
And that the plan is that's Jefferson Lab's responsibility. Anybody that wants to analyze data can go back and get at that. You just have to use Jefferson Lab resources to do it.
Right.
But the feeling is that most of the scientists would not actually go back to that. They would go to the next stage, which is nominally a factor of 10 smaller when you're actually doing analysis.
Yeah. Okay.
And those data sets, while they will exist at Jefferson Lab, it's also possible to envision them being copied off-site. Moving 50 or 100 terabytes is not insane.
Okay.
But the master copies would be at Jefferson Lab.
Yeah. And then the all of the data around calibration and all the inputs to data processing that we talked about, are those built into these numbers
Those are part of those numbers.
Okay.
It's an additional manpower. Maybe, Sean, you want to describe calibration a bit, or just in terms of...
Right now it's designed so that all these extra numbers are stored in databases, and so the databases are designed so that they can either be served up from a central location, or that they can actually be saved in a file and then distributed, you know, along with the actual data. So I think there's some in these SQL style databases and some in XML files, but they're all designed with standard tools that are all widely used and very portable. So
And it sounds like so that sort of jives with the Jefferson Lab document requesting or requiring, externalized human readable forms such as MySQL dump or whatever. Those databases are easy to sort of dump in that way.
What we use a lot is these SQL Lite databases, and so that's like a standalone SQL database, right?
Sure. Okay. Great.
And the databases themselves are, the Jefferson Lab IT division at least runs the servers that run those databases. We control what goes into them, but they make sure that they're backed up and
running and the services are available.
Right. Now, what about all the code? I mean, there's a lot of code flying around here in the various kind of steps. Do you have a sense for how much of that there is? Kind of what the quantity in number and size of files of that stuff there is.
Somebody have a line count?
I don't remember the last one, but I know that it's usually on the order of hundreds of thousands of lines of code.
Okay.
And it's in a version control repository also served by Jefferson Lab.
Okay. So maybe everyone, but specifically the folks from Jefferson Lab, can speak to this question of where, of data hosting, right? So we know that the raw data is hosted there on these tapes, but then as we get further down, we talk about the analysis data, 550 to 100 terabytes, that could be going out to universities individually. Yeah. Are kind of all levels of data at some point being held at Jefferson Lab? Or at some point, does Jefferson Lab sort of let go and say, this is now yours to manage locally?
Generally, after you've gone past the raw data phase, in the case of these large collaborations like BlueX and Class 12 who run in all speed, it's the collaboration who manages which files are kept, which files are discarded, and so on. All the IT division does is tries to make sure that nothing's lost accidentally. So, keep back of copies and archives of things. But because we don't know explicitly what is in all of these files, we leave it up to them to decide what to keep and what to discard.
So for Curtis and all the non-Jefferson Lab people, is there an infrastructure in place or a planned one for hosting that data?
Right now, we actually have a lot of data off-site right now that's been generated by simulation, and it's hosted on grid-enabled disk systems. The main one is at University of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And Justin has used that, and I don't know if you use that. And you have one of those now too, Sean, don't you? You have an SLA?
Yeah, we have a grid site up right now. I haven't done in much analysis on that.
Yeah, but that at least lets people sit at their home institution, and those grid-enabled disks look. They look like they're local, Justin, or do you actually have to make a copy?
It depends on how you run the job, so that a lot of the times if you want to access those, you can just copy them locally and then execute your scripts on the machine at your local institute. They sit out there like a big, it can act like a big web server basically where you just download your data, run your analysis, and then you can get rid of the file.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are all the reconstructed or simulated data, things like that. I mean, if you're talking about some of the results of these statistical analyses that Mark was talking about, if you want to consider that part of the data that's produced, I don't think that we've really talked about, come up with any policies of where to store that. I mean, I know in other experiments that I've been on, you know, usually that's left to the discretion of the individual researcher who does it, which has various results.
Yeah. We'll probably have a level that's beyond the rest where we have tried to do some categorizing of the data to speed up individual analyses, but then the individual research groups will pull those files out. And those are probably typically hundreds of gigabytes to a few terabyte type data samples, so not very large.
I think the tacit understanding is that the raw data and all of the reconstructed data and probably most of the relevant simulation will be archived at Jefferson Lab on magnetic tape because of cost and the infrastructure you need to operate such a large tape library which we invested in. So then but what happens beyond then is I don't think we've really grappled with that in a formal way.
Kind of what this is about, is what do we do? Because at some point, you know, those data ultimately lead to a publication, and at various stages farther in the analysis, it would be useful, you would think, to be able to archive that data for other people to use or for later analyses of our own that actually combine data sets or something. And we haven't really grappled with that yet, as Mark said. I think that's a lot of us know that's got to be there, but
I think we have an understanding, I think, that all of those data are freely available to any collaborator to take a copy and take as much of that as they would like to conduct their own research, you know, a component of the research. But like I said, I don't think the exact mechanism has been worked out. The other interesting thing is whether that can be shipped outside of the collaboration.
Yeah.
In any way. And I don't think we've really dealt with that in a formal way either.
I think we'd like to be able to, but you also, you know, there's all these other supporting databases and conditions and stuff that makes it harder to let the data go in a way that somebody else can use it. They don't understand how everything fits together.
Yeah. So it really sounds like, you know, for the most part, the stuff that is going to wind up living at Jefferson Lab long term, we actually have a fairly formalized and decent sense for what needs to happen with that data. It's what happens downstream from that things get a little bit more murky,
right?
So with that, you know, is there in the GLUEX experiment, is it an experiment or a project?
Both, I guess. You know, it took us how many years to build it?
$60 million.
We call it a thing, actually.
Is there someone or a group of people who are, you know, explicitly or implicitly responsible for data management, or is it really individual researchers who are involved who...
My guess is you're looking at most of the people right here that would actually be able, you know, that will formulate that sort of plan when we get there. We won't have any physics data until sometime next year.
Yeah.
We've had large simulated data sets, but to date we've been fortunate that they've all been at one site, so the management hasn't been particularly challenging. We're pushing ourselves with that simulated data to go beyond that, but...
Well, I think we do have these working groups, and so I think most of what you're talking about is that responsibility is centered in the working groups, which are sort of self-organizing groups of people that are interested in particular aspects of the experiment. Oftentimes it's not a particular detector, but in the case of the offline software, this is certainly one of the areas that particular working group talks about. There's also a physics working group, which is closely related in its sort of concerns. But I don't think you would say that it's up to the individual
to decide exactly how he's going to manage his own data. I think at least on a group level, there needs to be coordination and in fact collaboration wide. There is a structure for doing collaborative planning and and implementation of those plans.
And at least the analysis tools that you use to get there are pretty formalized. That with fairly high level software, that the expectation is a publishable analysis will be required to follow the standard practices and use the approved software. And I presume there will be some format that we'll have for, it's probably one of these so-called root formats from CERN that the data will have to be in, that we can keep track of it in the collaboration.
Yeah, so that does get to sort of another set of questions here about whether there are, for these kind of downstream from Jefferson Lab data products, whether there are any internally or externally applied standards for file naming, file organization, file formats, data documentation such as data dictionaries or metadata standards, any of that stuff. And you mentioned one bit of that, but
I'm pretty sure, correct, I would say we have, the formats are sort of have to be standard because we have tools that use those.
Mm-hmm.
We have not grappled with the file management yet. I mean, there's literally probably millions of files that could be scattered over many sites.
Yeah.
If we still have to come to grips with how do we keep track of all of that.
Okay. That's a good idea, though. Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do that.
Yeah.
I mean, is there? I know this is probably not an answer to this question, but is there a sense in the world of physics that you work in, of groups that are doing this the right way or who have really just kind of botched the job? Are there resources you can kind of talk to and say, hey, what was the, how did you deal with some of these issues? Or
some of these problems have been, I mean, they've been solved at various levels before and we're looking at things.
Okay.
I would say the LHC has to deal with this, but they are at least an order of magnitude bigger than we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And rely very heavily on grid,
mm-hmm.
which I think our reliance on that isn't as much. If anybody else wants to add comments on...
I guess if you're afraid of being too prescriptive in what you do, you could at least take the best practices route and would like to see them.
Yeah, well, it's...
Yeah.
Right, so I think most people have, they were grad students. They saw how it was done, and so there is sort of, there's the... what they call skill of the trade,
mm-hmm.
kind of ideas about how to handle data. I think people have been really good at it, and it's been botched by different groups. On the other hand, I think the major I don't think the data management itself has really been a make or break issue for these large experiments with large amounts of data. It may be that they spent too many resources or had too many mistakes in the way they did it, but they didn't actually lose the tapes or use the wrong constants to really screwed up their entire squandered their fortune on that kind of thing. People always tend to kind of muddle through on this. I mean, there are ways that people mess up, but I don't think I wouldn't say that this is one of the major ones. I think the pressure to do it well, it gets higher and higher though, with the volume of data.
Yeah.
It becomes more and more critical. It's harder and harder. You have to get to think about it more and more carefully.
I think the harder part of it, and that's the thing that people are starting to focus on now, is because we started to have these data mining things where people come back and look at old data. And it used to be that somebody took data in an experiment, they did the reconstruction and analysis and wrote the paper and everything else, and nobody cared about it afterwards. And as long as they got it right, you didn't need to worry about where all the files were spread.
Yeah.
But, now you get in this situation where the DOE in particular are very interested in data preservation and making sure that future generations, if they want to do something interesting with the data that we take, can come back and do it. So,
yeah, that's great. I think that's absolutely right on.
Just one more comment on that. I mean, we have been starting to look at different software packages and other ways of managing metadata for especially a lot of this reconstructed and simulated software, and that can be extended to some of these other things. So at least that is something in the offline group that we have been looking at.
Yeah, great.
And I think I'd also like to mention one feature of the simulated data that we're producing now, anyway, and the reconstructed data is it's in this this particular format, which is a compressed XML. So although it's not an XML file, it has a one-to-one correspondence with a valid XML rendering. So it's just a little corner of one piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole thing, but by doing that, the data is self-describing. And the dictionary for how to interpret that particular XML, what the tags are, what the attributes are, is stored with every single file, every instance of these files. And in fact, you can generate the program to do the decompression and the XML renderings, for example, if that's what you want to do. You can derive that from the header itself inside the file. And so the data is self-describing at that level. So that takes some pressure off of some of the kinds of things that one would normally have to do. Say, what version of the encoding did you use, when you put this thing together? It doesn't solve the problem, but it lops off a big piece of it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that root files have some of the same capabilities of introspection, and we're, looking at having standard ways of writing out, such derived files. So that helps.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, that does help. The next section here is about data sharing. And of course, there's a lot of data sharing we've been talking about within the experiment and the project, the thing. And I think I have a pretty good sense for what that data sharing process is, or those processes look like. Mm-hmm. It's happening across a number of institutions, I understand. You said something like 20 to 30 institutions.
Yeah.
Okay. But that there is sort of a core of data that is held and kind of parsed out as people need to grab it and use it.
Right.
At what point could you imagine, or at what point would you be willing to allow data sharing to happen beyond the research project as it stands?
I'd ask everybody to kick in. I would say, once you publish something on the data, at least you should consider opening it up.
Yeah.
That would be my statement. But you may also need to open it up, these people might have to come in and actually work with you to make any sense out of it.
Okay.
I would say that now you're getting into an area where we don't have a formal structure, obviously.
Right.
We're doing that yet. But
right.
Now you're getting an area where individuals in the field will, in the collaboration, might have different opinions.
Yeah.
About how you do that. You're starting to get into that, into getting us to argue with ourselves here, which I know you stated as a goal at the outset. But that's something where, it gets, different people have different ideas about how that should go.
So, one of the things we can do is flip this question a little bit and ask, how important is it to this research project to have a single answer or a single set of kind of guidelines for opening up data, say, after publication or in some other conditions? Or is that really, is it really that we're kind of producing this kind of massive core of data that people grab and use, and then once they're using it for their own purposes, it is up to them? There are a few ways to approach this.
I suspect that any data release would probably have to be approved by the collaboration. There'd have to be some policy or a vote or something on that.
Okay.
I'd also imagine it would have to be approved by the funding agency.
Yeah.
Bad example maybe, but I don't think DOE would be too happy if some Chinese institute came and took all of our data and produced a paper before we did.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
I think we really do want to have a single answer. I think that,
we do.
That would be our default goal. I'm just saying that we don't have that yet, and the road there is not necessarily obvious.
Right.
But I think we would like to have a specific policy.
It's one of these policies we have to develop over the next 18 months or so. Or at least start having a serious discussion about it. I think for a while the less likely to release data rather than just invite new collaborators in to come in and have access to it if they're participating in the experiment.
Right. But is there a standard of any sort in the field of particle physics or at all for, you know, once the publication happens, at least the data that were used to immediately produce that are shared, or is that not happening right now?
I'm going to ask other people because it's Sean. You have to. What happened with Clio?
Oh, with Clio. So Clio is still kind of the classic model, where the classic model of this is that, you know, if you're a member of the collaboration, then you get access to the data, and if not, you don't. And I think what happened with Clio is what happened with a lot of these experiments is that there was no plan for data preservation in place, not just the data, but all these databases and other things. And so, you know, there's really no capability at this point even for other people to go in and kind of analyze the data. So, in terms of what you were talking about before, I think it's important to note that the data that's taken doesn't contribute to just one paper, because it's sort of a general purpose data collecting. So generally, you know, you can get many different papers out of the same group of data, and so that kind of complicates it. I mean, I know that there's a few other experiments that are at least thinking about this. Like, I think some of the old WEP experiments will basically let anybody, anybody join and analyze their data, like Aleph, and I think that at least, you know, Babar is thinking about, something like this, but I don't know really any other experiments that have really gotten to the point where, you know, you have the whole software infrastructure and the technical knowledge that's needed to let other people, you know, just you know, Joe average theorist go out and analyze.
Yeah, I think Sean said the key word, which is what would you say, Sean? Technical knowledge and software infrastructure.
Yeah,
that is such a high threshold to cross, generally,
okay. Right.
To make sense of the data.
That
people are just not really interested in trying to do that unless they've been on the inside of that and been collaborating on those things and have easy access to it. So that's sort of a natural kind of barrier, actually, to sharing. And then the other thing is because you have the collaborators which have access to the data, easy access, they try to mine it for everything they can, and what's left is a pretty picked over mine, you know. A lot of the good stuff is gone, so that's also a disincentive for other people to learn how to do this later on and go on. In the past anyway, that's kind of been the case. So there was a sort of a naturalness to the model where only the collaborators were working on the data and no one else did. You know, it wasn't just because they decided that's the way it should be, but there's a sort of a practical aspect to that.
Right.
Are we certain that the funding bodies that may be involved truly understand that, or are they going to start trying to apply pressure to open the data?
You can never be sure.
That's
one of the constant fights is trying to prove to the funding agencies that, you know, this is what we have, and that it's not like, I don't know, some small desktop experiment where you can open up the data and it's easy.
Well, certainly you could argue that the field has suffered from that. In other words, because there's this barrier to data, I mean, we all could have gone back and looked at, Mark II data and found cool stuff there if if that wasn't just so freaking impossible, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, you could make that argument. I'm not saying it's a good thing that it was done, that it happened that way, but there's sort of a natural setting for why that might have happened.
Sorry. Yeah, I just make another comment sort of related. In talking with our sort of astrophysicists and cosmology friends and other people in other fields, especially satellite-based experiments run by NASA, most of that data is really available pretty early on in the process. So there's a lot of people who aren't a part of those experiments who are analyzing that data pretty early on. So it's not inconceivable that sort of mindset would sort of drift in our direction.
Yeah, and that's true, but I mean, that does tend to be pretty reduced data sets as well. So, you know, you can also think of something like a staged release of data where, at some point you release just, four vectors, momentums and energies of particles that were detected, and then, later on let people access the full data or something like that.
Right. So apart from, issues that DOE might have about national security or whatnot, what are there any restrictions that should or could be placed on the data sets? If we do get to a point where there's sort of an openness around these data, are there restrictions or maybe embargoes that you might put on the data? Or if openness is the goal, is it just sort of openness?
Yeah, I don't think we've grappled with that one really. If we were forced to open it up, I mean, we'd have to do it, but there would always be the concern that what was being done didn't make any sense because the people...
Okay, yeah, that.
But I the back of all of our mind, we would like to be able to have the data live beyond the experiment and be out there, but I don't know if there's been a real successful model of that in particle physics to date.
Right. Okay.
I think we'll just have to settle for a statue of Curtis,
That would be awesome. So as far as the interview protocol goes, sort of the questions that we have that we typically ask at this stage, we've kind of run through most of that. And I think from this we have a fairly good sense, if we can decipher what we've, talked about today, for some of the major issues that have come up around the data sets that are being created, and hopefully we can come back to you with some document describing issues that we need to discuss further or best practices, and kind of start formulating a plan.
We'd be more than happy to iterate this. It's not going to be a one-shot.
No, at all. Yeah, I think it'll be necessary to discuss further.
But I think it also will force us to start over the next, 6 months or 8 months addressing some of these issues internally as well.
Right.
It will have to happen.
Great. So from where I sit, I'm ready to go back and start trying to digest this. But
okay. Anybody have any questions or anything here, or additional comments? Silence. Okay. Well, thanks for everyone's time. I think it was actually useful to have this discussion.
Thank you all for participating.
Thank you for bringing up.
Yeah. Sure.
And some of you may be being pinged by your librarians or something at some point. You never know.
You may, yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you all.
Then.
Thank you. Okay. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Thank you.
I guess we have a meeting tomorrow with some of us. Okay. Yeah. Paul's got some info, so. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Should we hang up? Let's hang up.
Thank you. Please stand by.